I'm in studio today with Jerry Goodspeed, who is USU's horticulture extension agent, and it's our Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That segment. And the first one that I'm going to look at with Jerry is Cintranthus, also known as Jupiter's beard. So, Jerry, why is this on your list of plants not to put in?
Well, it's kind of odd because it is a beautiful plant and it is dry. I mean, it can grow in a lot of dry locations. However, Jupiter's beard is also very aggressive, and you know, it likes friends around, and so if you plant it by itself, pretty soon you go out there in a year, and there's 7 or 8 friends, and pretty soon there's 20 friends, and pretty soon there's 400. And the other thing that and this is what my wife pointed out, so I grew it for a little while, and my wife pointed out, the problem with this stupid plant is you can't pull it out of the ground unless the ground has had about 17 inches of rain on it, because it has a deep root system, and it's just really hard to pull. Other than that, it's really a nice plant.
Okay, so what keeps it in check? Because I'm thinking of one that I did plant like maybe 10 years ago, and after about 7 or 8 years, I noticed, okay, there were little plantlets all over the place, and maybe it was the weather for that winter happened to be really bad, because it didn't come back 1 year, and I thought, I'm going to leave this out. But I just put in another one in a really dry location that I don't like to water. Am I up the creek?
No, you're not.
Okay.
It's okay. And as I say, the good thing is it'll bloom all year. And maybe this is a good plant for people with brown thumbs, because, you know, you can just barely get it to survive, and so it's not going to get any offspring.
So what does it look like? When does it bloom?
It blooms almost all year. It'll bloom from, you know, May until September. And it's kind of an odd color. It's kind of the color of...
It's kind of like a mauve.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, see, that's what I'm going to call it.
If it's not just a red or a pink, then I'm kind of thrown off.
It's kind of in between.
Yeah. And that's kind of, and it has variability, too. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but it can't make up its mind. So it's red and then pink and then some color I can't explain and then... That's kind of a salmon-y looking color, and a mauve, I guess, is a good description.
And they're small flowers. I mean, it's like a cluster of a lot of small flowers. Yeah. Do you deadhead them to keep them blossoming?
I deadhead them right to the ground.
So you really don't care for this plant.
Oh, I can't say that. It does have its place. That place is usually somebody else's yard, but... you know, it's got a unique color to it, and it can be a little bit aggressive. Let's say that.
All right. So if you put it in an area where it doesn't get a lot of water, does it seem to do just fine and will continue to spread?
Yeah,
I'm
actually,
asking this
it does.
Because of personal. I'm like, I just put this in, so it's easy for me to take it up and put it somewhere else.
Yeah, actually, we have it planting at the Utah house where we don't water it at all, and it does quite well. And it tends to, as I say, in our situations there. And it is full sun there. It does tend to fill in those areas quite a bit. A little bit of shade, it's not going to bloom quite as much. It's not going to be quite as aggressive. Give it and it can do, as I say, it does fine without any water. But for it to do its best, it full sun and a little bit of water.
Where do you usually find, where does this grow in nature that's without any help from mankind?
I have no idea. That's a good question. The word that comes to mind probably isn't appropriate for radio. But
and
I don't know where it's native to.
And what are butterflies attracted
to
it?
Yeah, it is good for butterflies and bees. Yeah.
So if you've got an area that you just can't get anything to grow in, maybe that might be the area to put it in.
Yeah, I guess that's a pretty good idea. You know, you get those wildflower mixes, and when they come with about 30 different wildflowers, and after 2 years, you're down to 2. This would be one of the ones that would be left over that would still be blooming. So, yeah, you could put it into those areas where it can just go ahead and bloom and grow, and you don't have to maintain it much. But probably a great plant for that.
So why do they put it in these mixes? Just because they know it does grow so well and they want to make sure that you see green and flowers the first year?
I don't know. I think because it's a cheap seed, if you really want my opinion.
Okay. Because you can find it everywhere.
Yeah, you can. It's just a cheap seed.
Okay.
And you know, a lot of that's just driven by finances.
So our Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That plant for today is Jupiter's Beard, also known as Cintranthus. And you can find it at garden centers all over the place, but if you can, avoid it. But if you get swayed by the color, which is what I did when I bought this second plant, put it somewhere that you don't want everything else to be taken
away. Don't want it to overtake. That's
all
correct.
Right. Jerry, thanks for coming in. Jerry Goodspeed is a USU Extension Horticulture agent in Weber County, and he joined me on this segment of Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That. Coming up next, we have Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. Helen Cannon is a former English teacher at Utah State University and also a garden enthusiast and someone who really enjoys literature, and I think you'll appreciate this next segment.
This is Helen Cannon with another installment of Petals and Prose. And today I've been thinking about gardens in letters, epistolary gardens. Legendary editor at The New Yorker during the first 34 years, Catherine S. White was also a great garden enthusiast. In March 1958, she began publishing her popular column, Onward and Upward in the Garden. Her first column elicited loads of fan mail, but one letter in particular caught her attention. From Elizabeth Lawrence, a noted Southern garden writer, it was filled with suggestions and encouragement. When Catherine wrote back her appreciation, she reported on her main garden and discussed plants and books that interested her. Thus began a correspondence that would last for almost 20 years until Catherine's death in 1977. The book, Two Gardeners, is a collection of these luminous letters. The letters bring to life the unique epistolary friendship between two intelligent women, both of them avid gardeners and readers, both at a stage of life when to make a new friend was rare indeed. When they first wrote to one another, Catherine was 62, Elizabeth 54. More than 150 letters went back and forth during the course of their correspondence, and they would never meet face to face. So the first fan letter from Elizabeth Lawrence to Catherine White is as follows. And I should say that gardeners are often good letter writers, and whether they write to describe what's blooming today or to remember a flower from childhood, their letters are efforts to preserve memories of gardens. Marianne Moore, the poet, wrote in her poetry that poetry should have imaginary gardens with real toads in them. And so this is in that vein, imaginary gardens with real toads in them. And this is the first fan letter from Elizabeth Lawrence to Catherine White. Dear Mrs. White, I'm very grateful to Joseph Mitchell's sister for calling my attention to your story about the catalogs. Our New Yorker is a family affair, and it sometimes gets under somebody's bed before anyone else sees it, and I sometimes miss the very thing I would have liked best. I not only enjoyed the article, I profited from the advice, and I am particularly glad to know about roses of yesterday and today. I don't know how I managed to garden for nearly 50 years without hearing of Will Tiltson, but I did. It is a principle with me never to pay for catalogs, but I gladly sent the Honorable Secretary 50 cents just for the Lady Carolyn Howard. But do you know Roy Hennessy? And you shouldn't miss Cecil Hoydeschel's little brochures twice a year. I think he's in his 90s now, so you better hurry. He always begins, Dear Flora Friends. One issue has a picture of him with his great-grandchild. One of his letters offered a litter of cocker puppies for sale. In his spring 1957 issue, he says he plans to live to be 100 but will settle for 97. And as he had two grandparents who lived to be that old and uncles and aunts who lived longer, he thinks he has a good chance. I have all of them, the catalogs. The last 22 years, one was missing, but I sent a dime and got it, and consider them among my treasures. One of the interesting things in that catalog is to see how a gardener's taste changes from year to year. Irises, then daylilies, then African violets, then orchids. But always the amaryllids, and always some bulb that you can't get anywhere else. But my favorite of all is Park's flower book, Park Seed Company, Greenwood, South Carolina. The new ones are on slick paper with the same color photographs that are in all the catalogs, but they can't compare with the old line drawing ones. But the first page still carries in a little box. It used to have quaint little floral design around the edge, but now just a black line. A prayer by John Henry Jowett about God's love and beauty, and at the bottom emphasized by an arrow. It used to be a hand with a fancy cuff and a pointing finger. My friends, are these your sentiments? If not, why not? George W. Park. It still has a picture in the left-hand corner of George W. Park, founder, 1852 to 1935, the date of the founding, 1868, and a quotation from Emerson and an adorable cut of a boy in a sailor suit and hat rolling a wheelbarrow, bursting with flowers while a little girl holds a parasol over him. And beneath, yes, sister, I buy only Park. His seeds always grow and yield the finest flowers. Mr. Park, one of the catalogs said, is a descendant of John Knox, and he looks like it. His two sons, usually pictured, have the same grim mouth, but they have their mother's eyes. A picture of Mrs. Park in the balance wheel of the 1947 catalog, in which George B. Park is now president, pays tribute to a heroine from real life, my mother, a God-fearing woman. She doesn't look as fearful as the men of the family. During the war, Brother William W.J. Park, grower, and I were in service, and she carried on alone of the Park family, sometimes worked 16 hours a day to get your orders to you on time. She really did get them there. They usually come by return mail. Until the war, all seeds were 10 cents a package, 11 for a dollar. Mr. Park said most people wanted only a few of a kind, and there was no wasting them, so he just put them in smaller packages. A jumbo was a quarter, still is, but the small ones are now 15 cents, 15 for $2, 40 for $5. You can save by ordering for your friends if you don't need that many. Then she concludes the letter thanking Mrs. White and asks, I asked Mrs. Lamb if you were Mrs. E.B. White, and she said you were. So please tell Mr. E.B. that he has three generations of devoted readers in my family. My mother's favorites were the one about leaving the mirror in the apartment vestibule and the one about homemade bread, but my niece adores Charlotte's Web. Sincerely, Elizabeth Lawrence. And so Catherine White responds to this lovely fan letter on June 4th, 1958. Dear Miss Lawrence, it was delightful to get your letter, so full of interesting and helpful suggestions about garden catalogs. I had already caught up too late with that of George W. Park Seed Company, and I admire it, but of course I've only seen the latest. Your descriptions of the earlier Park Seed book make my mouth water, and I wish I had some of them. I shall send right off for Cecil Houdeshell's brochures and for some other catalogs you mentioned. I already have one copy of the Barnhaven catalog, which is charming, but I can't raise primroses. They make my hands break out. I go on accumulating catalogs of every sort, though, in the hope that someday I may get time and good ideas to write another catalog review, but it is quite likely I never shall. Your suggestions will spur me on, if anything could, but I am an editor, not a writer. Of course, as a gardener, I'm a rank amateur and very disorganized because I have so little time and strength for it. I gave your messages to my husband, who is most grateful for them. Joe Mitchell is one of our favorite friends and writers, and I was happy to hear he recommended my review to his sister and she to you. I consider any recommendation from Joe a great honor. Sincerely yours, Catherine S. White. P.S. I have only just now heard of your garden book, and I plan to send to the North Carolina Press for it. This correspondence continues for 21 years, over 150 letters that are charming, that deal with gardens and flowers and the incidents in ordinary lives. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
Thank you for joining us on Access. There we go, the old program on the Zesty Garden. That was Helen Cannon, a former English teacher at Utah State University and a lover of literature and all things garden. And I appreciate her coming on the program. Now we're going to move into the main body of the program because we have Dan Drost, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist. And we'd like to take your vegetable questions at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Dan, thanks for coming in.
It's good to be here again.
Number of issues that I'm thinking of. Number one is the heat. It's been really hot. And even for Cache Valley, when it's hitting triple digits in Cache Valley, that's pretty warm.
Well, you know, what I was kind of looking at recently is how early it's come. Normally, we get some hot weather. We get some days in the hundreds. But I don't know that we get them in late June and early July. You know, that's, you know, kind of, to me, a little bit unusual. And as a result, you know, our garden plants tend to struggle a little bit. Now, my basil has never been so good. I mean, it's just like growing like a weed. And I've made some great pesto already with it. And we've eaten a lot. And local tomatoes are just starting to come on. And so, you know, there's lots of possibilities with that. But boy, this earliness of the heat, I think, is somewhat problematic because we've got plants that are really sensitive stages, or we're trying to do certain things, and that's, you know, impacting how those plants are going to perform, you know, immediately and, you know, potentially how they're going to perform in the future.
Now, certain plants love heat, and they just grow and grow and grow, but at some point, the heat affects those plants, such as the flowers begin to drop off and you don't get fruit set. So,
well, let's talk about a few of those ones. You know, certainly we're at the point where many of our cool season crops are, you know, kind of coming to the end. You know, if we've had early lettuce or if we've had some radishes or something like that, a couple things happen. You know, A, under hot weather conditions and also under the longer day lengths that we have. You know, we just passed the longest day of the year and in late June. Those are two triggers, long days and hot temperatures are triggers for these plants to produce flowers. And so you'll see that occurring generally in early June. These plants start to transition to that. And then when we get some hot weather, it just accelerates that reproductive development. And for the most part in radishes, you know, if we're growing lettuce or some of the leafy mustards and things like that, we really don't want the flower part of it or the seed stalk part of it. We're interested in the leaf or, you know, the swollen root part in the case of a radish. And so those things matured off really early. And then the second problem that we see when hot temperatures come, then we also get these compounds within the plant that are more bitter or they're a little bit more spicy. So our radishes early on are, you know, you can tell there's a little bit of a snap to them or bite to them. But boy, when it gets hot, it's almost like, ugh, you know, they get so strong that you just don't really like to eat them. And so those are responses that the plant has relative to the environmental conditions that they've seen. And with the heat coming on in late June and through early July here, you know, those things happen quicker. The other thing that we tend to see is in crops like broccoli. We've got some research studies going with broccoli right now, and they're just beginning to head. But, you know, they take on a bitter flavor too, even, you know, because there are these glycosides that are formed in there. They're sulfur containing compounds, and they get sharp and they get strong, and you know, our tongue doesn't necessarily like those things. And so, you know, I can understand why people don't, you know, sometimes like broccoli, and they say, ugh, you know, that stuff tastes bad, because they may be more sensitive to it. And then with the effect of the stress that the plant is under, the higher temperatures that it's not used to growing under, or, you know, it's not made to grow under, it does better under cooler conditions, then it just builds up these compounds in it even more. And so you tend to say, oh, it has a very strong metallic taste, or it has a more sulfury taste to it. And those are symptoms of the higher temperatures that we're having to deal with.
Is there a way to mitigate that at all?
Well, you know, some people would say, you know, if you can try and reduce the temperature. So, you know, how do you do that? I mean, I don't know how to reduce the temperature on the grand scale. Some people say shading helps. You know, certainly keeping the plant well hydrated helps. And so, you know, adding a little bit of extra water, making sure that the plant never really becomes under water stress, that's one way to at least keep the plant cool, because More water in the root system allows the plant to take it up more freely. It can transpire it out of the leaves a little bit more quickly, and that transpirational process tends to, you know, cool the plant off. And so shading will also reduce it. But, you know, these aren't things that a farmer really could do on a large scale, but certainly a home gardener could do those with a little bit of effort on their part. You know, they could think of ways to create some shade, you know, and we often see that, you know, people will say, well, I'm going to grow my lettuce or I'm going to grow some of these cooler weather crops on the north side of my property, behind a house where there's almost all shade during the day, et cetera, in an attempt to try and, you know, keep the temperature down. But, you know, I can't really find a cool spot in my yard right now. Yeah, it's cooler under the tree, but the light level is so low underneath there, sometimes these plants don't perform very well either if you have such deep shade that the plants are growing in. So there's a lot of little things that are happening. And so we transition away from our cooler weather crops at this time of the year, and we start focusing our attention on the warm weather crops like zucchinis and our tomatoes and our peppers and, you know, those kinds of plants, which you know, like warmer conditions, but even they don't really like it when it's up around the 100 degree mark.
So if you're in St. George, you just don't grow your garden this time of year?
Well, a lot of St. George gardeners, you know, kind of try to maintain things like pepper and tomato and, you know, watermelons and stuff like that over the course of the summer. You know, they water an awful lot. They're trying to create an environment that's a little bit more favorable for the growth. You know, oftentimes they just don't get the kind of quality that they expect. The fruit set isn't nearly as good, and we'll talk about why that might occur. And, you know, they're just kind of trying to keep the plants going so that, you know, come mid-August when the temperature starts to back off a little bit, then those plants recover. You know, leaves and stems and things like that tend to tolerate the heat a little bit more than, you know, very sensitive reproductive structures like a flower or a young fruit. And so if you can just kind of get it through this hot time of the year, then ultimately, you know, come September, you're going to have it come back into production. And, well, the weather is good in September and October, and you can get, you know, a recurrence of productivity out of that plant that allows you to have some stuff until, you know, quite late in the growing season.
So it sounds like the basic thing that we can do is keep them well hydrated. Maybe the having some of that, if the soil is a little bit more moist, it will help keep the temperature down a little bit around the plant. I mean, it doesn't sound like it'll do a whole lot, but it will help some.
And it does, you know. So mulching and things like that, we talk about using straws or, you know, even grass clippings or, you know, something on the soil surface that does two things. It reduces the evaporation that occurs when we do apply water to the soil, but it also tends to reduce the sun load on the soil surface, which drives evaporation, but it also, you get that transfer of heat. So as that surface starts to heat up, heat gets transferred deeper and deeper into the soil profile, and, you know, you can measure those changes, and those changes can be significant, and roots, you know, as they begin to warm up, get less efficient at what they're supposed to do, which is take up water and take up nutrients. And so the plant then comes under more stress because it's heat load. And we often see that in pots, you know. So a lot of us put a plant in a pot, stick it on a patio. Patio is made of what? It's concrete or stone or something like that. And if you went in and, you know, you feel your pots, and they get pretty warm, and that heat gets transferred into that. And so, therefore, it may be necessary for us to irrigate those pots in the morning and then water them again in the evening, you know, particularly if the pot is a dark-colored pot, which absorbs more heat. Whereas if it's a lighter-colored pot, it will reflect more of that heat and doesn't heat up nearly as quickly, but it's still heating up, believe me. You know, I kind of do all the pot watering around my house and my flowers, you know, during this hot time, you know, really don't look quite as good. You know, I try to find ones that tend to do better under the heat of summer, but some of them just struggle. And if you can kind of keep them through, you know, come mid-August, all of a sudden they start to perk up again, and then they're really looking nice in the fall. And so, you know, it's a battle, and it's a heat load issue that we really are addressing. And I just think it started a little bit early this year, and it might be something that you talk to one of the climate center people about and say, you know, does it seem like it's been hotter earlier this year, and what's causing that, and why is that? And, you know, they may just say, well, the weather patterns are such that, you know, I talked to my sister-in-law in Wisconsin, and she says, man, all we've been getting is wet. You know, it's been rain, and here we are is just hot.
I mean, so, did we even have a trace? I think I had a trace in my house in June of a moisture.
Yeah, I think we did, which, you know, June is, as I understand it, one of our drier months anyway, but, you know, it's kind of unusual that we don't get a storm or something like that. And, you know, in some ways I'm looking forward to maybe a few storms, provided they don't bring two things with them, high winds and potential for hail. And both of those things can happen. And, you know, that can be devastating to the garden again. So, you know, that's just another thing for us gardener types to, you know, kind of worry about. And, you know, I just, you know, want to say that I quit worrying about some of those things a long time ago because I can't do anything about the weather. But I can think about what's causing the problems in my plants. And then I can say to you, well, let's try this or let's try that. Or in order to, you know, try and get these plants so that they maintain some level of productivity that provides, you know, fresh tomatoes for my table, you know, or cucumbers or whatever that are, you know, of quality that I can consume, and I, you know, don't have somebody that says, whoa, that doesn't taste very good.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is my guest today, and if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Dan is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we'd love to take your questions. 1-800-826-1495, or send us an email, zestygarden@gmail.com. Okay, so talking about these pots, and I think of the ones that I've got sitting out on my back porch. It does make sense. I mean, I've got one pot that's like a half a wine barrel that I've got a dahlia growing in, and it does pretty well because it's pretty big. I'm sure if I put a tomato in it, it would probably do pretty good because there's a lot of area for the plant to grow and to distribute the heat. Then I've got a smaller pot that I've got basil in, and the basil just absolutely loves it. It's going crazy.
Yeah, and basil really likes it warm. If you keep it fairly well hydrated, the big problem is if it comes under a little bit of stress, and, you know, we went away over the 4th of July weekend, and, you know, what I did is I thought, well, you know, I got nobody to come around and water, you know, and so how am I going to keep my pots reasonably moist? And so I just said, okay, I'm going to stick them out in the lawn where the sprinkler comes on, and I'm going to change my sprinkler pattern so that instead of, you know, about every third day irrigation, I'm going to just, for 3 days, I'm going to water it every day so that my pots get some water and they get through it. And they got through it fairly well. And then there was a couple days where, for whatever reason, I didn't water my pots. I wasn't thinking clearly. I think the heat was getting to me. And the next day, you know, I got up in the morning, and then the basil was a little bit wilty looking. And so I went back in and irrigated. And now I'm looking at those plants, and I'm seeing that some of them are transitioning to flowering. You know, and a flower stalk will form on a basil. And sometimes if you maintain them, they stay pretty much vegetative for a longer period of time. And so I think I kind of...
So that just that little bit of stress.
Little bit of stress just tricked them into saying, okay, I'm going to flower. And so now it's about time for my second harvest. So we'll make some pesto this weekend. You know, I'll trim those things back hard. And I think maybe I'll come back to vegetative. I'll give them a little bit of fertilizer. But they like it warm, you know, and I've always struggled a little with the basil when I put it out in the garden. You know, it doesn't really kick into growing very vigorously until, you know, mid to late July and then through August. And I think it's basically because, you know, it just doesn't get enough warmth, and the root system likes to be warm as well as the tops do. And so it's really done exceedingly well in these pots, and it has to do with that heat load. Just the plant favors those kinds of conditions, and its wild location for development has the southern Mediterranean area of Greece and southern Italy, which is pretty hot type conditions and fairly dry type conditions there as well. And so I think we're kind of mimicking more of that when we put it in the in our pots rather than in the garden soil per se. And so it likes that.
If ever there was a prima donna plant,
basil's
got to be it, because it doesn't like it if it gets below 40 degrees, and you give it a little bit of stress. Oh, I've got to go to seed.
Yeah, and it is a real prima donna.
It's sure worth it, though.
But it's, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's, you know, one of my favorites anyway for, you know, just adding a mix to a whole bunch of different stuff. So that's one of those issues. You know, we have to be thinking about this heat load that's there. And yet at the same time, you know, you think corn. Here's corn. It's a plant that really likes it hot. And I was with one of our commercial corn growers, sweet corn growers, yesterday, and he was complaining that he had a couple varieties that he traditionally grows throughout the whole season. It has really high quality. It's a bicolored corn. They've started picking their earliest plantings, and so the early planting of sweet corn is coming on, and you can start to see Utah corn around. Yet he was saying that for his late September plantings, which have to be planted now, he said the soil temperatures are so high that the little seedlings are coming up. And as soon as they get up to the soil surface, the seed leaf, which they call the cotyledon, and in corn it's called the coleoptile, but it's basically the cotyledon, and the first leaf right at ground level is burning the stem of that plant right off. And wow. So it's kind of frying the leaves because the soil is so warm. And so we went out and looked at a couple fields, and I mean, I didn't have a thermometer with me to actually measure what that surface temperature was like, but I poked my finger in there, and the soil was dry, and it was, I mean, really hot. And then one of the kids that worked for me said, yeah, the other day we were planting this trial at the research farm, and the soil had been worked up, and it was kind of dry, and we went out there, and I'm in my shorts, and I didn't have any socks on, but I had my shoes on, and some of that soil fell down inside my shoe, and I thought my foot was going to burn, he says. The soil was so hot. And so, you know, here's a plant that likes it hot, but it can be almost too hot. And so this, with these 100-degree temperatures and low humidities and dry soils and it's dark-colored, you know, it's like putting the hand on top of the hood of your black, you know, car. You know, you can't hold it there very long, and you could probably fry an egg on the hood on some of these days because it is basically so hot. And so these plants don't like that. So there he was having a problem with getting the crop out of the ground and established. And once the plants were up, he said, you know, then it wasn't a problem. But just getting them up sometime was a bit of an issue. And then we have to be thinking about, well, how do these plants deal with the heat as they're trying to grow their leaves? And then particularly for these fruiting type plants like tomato or pepper or sweet corn, you know, what happens if we have too much heat around a critical time during that development? And what does that do to the plant?
So, okay, I picked up on something here. So is it too late to plant corn? I guess it depends on where you live.
I think, you know, down in the Salt Lake region, they're getting toward the last of their plantings, usually around the 15th of July. And most of these corn are 70 to 75 day corns. That's what they grow because it has a little longer ears and it has a lot more rows around the kernels. And, you know, they have a kind of a market requirement that they're trying to meet. So if you think about planting corn middle of July and then you have 75 days, you know, 1 month would be the middle of August, 1 month would be the middle of September. So a 75-day corn is going to come on and mature around the last week of September or the first week of October. And they know they can sell corn right up until maybe the 10th to the 15th of October. There'll be still a market for it. You know, he's at the very end of his plantings, but he said in his own right, he said, it's an unusual year. He said, because I don't necessarily have this problem with this one variety, and it's given me problems, and this is my kind of standard. This is my flag bearer on my farm. And, you know, this other variety that I grow, I'm having less problems with it. But I don't necessarily like the quality of this corn as much as I love this other one. And so he's just going, what seems to be going on? I just said to him, well, it seems to me to be a little bit hotter earlier this year because we normally get hot weather starting the middle of July until like the middle of August, and there's periods in there where it's the warmest of the year. And he was just kind of concerned and wondering what he could do. And I said, well, you really, the thing that you can do is, you know, you have to irrigate. And he says, well, I like to get the corn up first before I irrigate, because sometimes if I irrigate while I'm trying to emerge the corn, then, you know, there's too much moisture there, and that creates a different problem for me. Or the soil surface gets a little crusty, and then I have to do some things to try and, you know, break up that crust so that the leaves and grow up through that soil. So he says, I really like to have my moisture there, plant to moisture, and let it come up. And so, you know, we were just kind of strategizing on, you know, what was going on, how it could be rectified. And then he was kind of curious about why these varieties were different in terms of how they were tolerating those conditions. And you know, it's a complex thing.
Being a farmer, there's just so many different things that you've got to worry about.
That's exactly right. And he was worried about it because he says, you know, I have a market for corn at this time. And he says, you know, I'm down to the last 10 acres that I have to plant, and I plant X number of acres every so many days in order to kind of meet my market needs. And he says, I'm a little worried about it. I'm going to be a little short toward the end of the season. And so he just says, every year brings something different. And he says, this is just unusual. And he's been growing corn for 25 years. So, I mean, you know, he's seen it all, I thought. And he says, this is a new one.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is my guest for this program. We're going to take a quick break and hear a Melinda's Gardening Moment, and then we'll be back talking with Dan Drost. We hope you call with your questions or comments, 1-800-826-1495, or send us your email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com.
Hardy, edible, and the 2013 International Herb of the Year make elderberry a great plant for any size landscape or even container gardens. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Elderberries flower and fruit best in full sun, but will tolerate shade. They prefer moist soil, but also tolerate drought, making them great choices for rain gardens. The American elder grows 5 to 12 feet tall and produces white flowers midsummer on new growth. The flowers are used for perfumes and food. You and the birds will enjoy the fruit that appears in late summer. Though self-fruitful, you will have a larger crop with several plants. Cultivars of the European elder provide additional ornamental value to the landscape. Black Lace has dark purple dissected leaves and grows 6 to 8 feet tall. With a bit of pruning, it can be a good substitute for Japanese maple in areas where that plant struggles. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll hear the sensual sounds of bossa nova and samba, both fused with electronica and neo-soul in today's club culture and in its more classical traditional sound. I'm Rosalie Howard. Join us for the best of Brazil, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Free Oyster Ridge Music Festival, July 26th through 28th in Kemmerer, Wyoming. 13 bands including The White Buffalo, Holy Ghost Tent Revival, and Hot Day at the Zoo. Information at oysterridgemusicfestival.com.
In our gardening calendar, the Stokes Nature Center in Logan Canyon is hosting an edible and medicinal plant walk on Saturday. This Saturday from 9 to 11:30, local naturalist Jack Green will introduce you to the edible, medicinal, and otherwise useful plants of Logan Canyon. Participants will meet at Wood Camp at the trailhead for the Jardine Juniper Trail. The event is free, but a donation is appreciated. Information is at logannature.org. The Utah Botanical Center in Kaysville is hosting a diagnostic clinic on Wednesday, July 17th from 3 to 6 p.m. If you have any problems with trees and shrubs, lawns, vegetables, or flower gardens, their master gardeners can help. Information is on their website at utahbotanicalcenter.org. And then USU Extension is hosting a course on harvesting rainwater Saturday, August 3rd at 9 a.m. at the Iron County Visitor Center, 581 North Main in Cedar City. This course will provide an overview of rainwater harvesting, history, uses, and applicability to conserving rainwater, rainfall as a natural resource. To register, call 435-586-8132. And the City of Price is hosting the High Desert Growers Farmers Market Saturdays from 9 to noon at Main Street and 100 East. The Escalante Farmers Market is held Saturdays from 9 to 12 at the corner of Main Street and Center Street. And then last but not least, if you need help knowing how to dig and divide your iris, there is a demonstration with hands-on experience this Tuesday, July 16th at 6:30. Come to 2270 North, 1600 East in North Logan. Participants will be shown how to divide and take care of an iris clump. Iris rhizomes will be given to those who come. More information is at 757-5102. I have with me in studio Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we are talking about vegetables, heat stress, how to keep things watered, how to make sure that you can do those things to help your vegetables continue on through the summer. And Dan, one of the things that I know that we wanted to talk about was hydration issues. How do you keep things watered? Should you water in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening? How often during the week? I know a lot of that depends on what soil type you have as well.
Well, it does. And I think that's the first place you have to start is, you have to assess what your soil is. And, do you have a sand? Do you have a clay? Or do you have a combination of things, sand, silts, and clays, which would say you have a loamy type soil? And then you also have to kind of think about how deep that soil is as well. I live up by on the boulevard up near the Logan Temple, and I have about 4 or 5 inches of soil, and then I have cobble and rock and gravel underneath that, which doesn't hold a lot of water in it. Kind of how I have to irrigate is going to differ from somebody who's a little farther out in the valley or a little farther north that has, a much, much deeper soil. So if we went out to, near North Logan, those soils are, sandy loams or loamy type soils. They're quite deep, and as a result of that, they have a much, much better water holding capacity. And so, to say to someone, this is how much to water every week, doesn't really help you in any way until you know what your soil is like. And so, if you aren't certain about what your soil is like, you can, through the soil testing lab, you can send it in and it'll tell you, okay, this is a sandy loam soil, or this is a clay loam soil, or this is a sand. So as well as giving you the nutrient values that are there. And then you also need to kind of do a little bit of exploration. Get one of your kids on a shovel and have them dig a hole and kind of look at what the soil is and kind of get an idea of how deep it is. And that will then start to help you make a better assessment of how much you need to water. And so we talk about at this time of the year, you might need about an inch to an inch and a half of water a week. And then the question comes, well, should I stick that on one time, two times a week, three times a week? It kind of depends on what system you have. I know you, living in Hyde Park, you have, an irrigation water that comes in from the canal, and you have a turn one time a week. So you're forced to do one of two things, either rely on that to supply all your irrigation needs, or you supplement it with hand watering or a hose or something which comes from a culinary source. So we tend to kind of get ourselves into a bind when we start doing that, because we also want to be conserving of the resource that we have, and yet we also want our plants to thrive. And then you add on another layer, and the next layer is what plants we're growing. So the rule that I tend to tell gardeners about is that short-statured plants tend to have shallow roots, and tall plants tend to have deep roots. And so if you're growing a plant like a squash, sweet corn, those are considered tall-type plants, and they have roots that go quite deeply into the soil, maybe 2 feet or 3 feet in the soil, depending on what's underneath. So in my shallow and soil environment, they may not go that deep, but they are growing down into that gravel zone and occupying that space and extracting water from there. Whereas if you're growing lettuce or an onion or something like that, they tend to have shallow roots because the plants don't grow very tall. And what we as gardeners tend to do is mix things up. You know, our garden has tall plants near short plants and all of those other things. And as a result, now I have to say to you, well, what are you irrigating for? Well, right now I'm irrigating for my tomatoes and my peppers and my squash because those are the crops that are most important to me. And they tend to, even in those realms, have differences in rooting depth. And so you may overwater some and you may slightly underwater others, and that gets us into some problems. And so the first thing we really should be doing is kind of zoning our garden based on stature, how tall or how short I am. And that then changes what I have to do in terms of my irrigation, so that you could get by with a single irrigation event from your irrigation supply water for those taller stature plants, because I'm going to put it on for a reasonably long period of time and I'm going to wet the soil profile deeply. And then I may have to supplement for some of those shorter statured ones with an additional irrigation during the course of the week before my next one comes forward. So you see, it's not so simple for us. And so we tend to do one type of water for all the different plants. And then we say, well, this one doesn't do so well, and this one doesn't do so well because they're either under or over watered. And then this one's kind of doing pretty good. And we get frustrated.
Well, Dan, you're not going to believe this, but we've already reached the end of our time.
Have we now?
Yeah. Good. I really appreciate you coming in, and you've been listening to Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and this is The Zesty Garden. Coming up next is Take a Hike. This is the Take a Hike segment of The Zesty Garden. I have with me David Wallace, who's a leader with Cache Hikers and on the board of the Utah Native Plant Society. And one of the hikes that is done so often around here, but there's still so many people, David, that I run into that have not been to Tony Grove when the wildflowers are out. So now is the time to do that.
Yes. I lived in Salt Lake for a while, and then August was the big wildflower month. But here up in northern Utah, July, and this is the time you want to be there.
So what are you going to find at Tony Grove? This is, of course, you've got the lake. You can park really close. In fact, if you never want to get out of your vehicle, you could just look up onto the hillside and see quite a bit. But I would advise getting out.
Well, since we're talking about hiking, this is not really a hike, more of a walk, but I'm going to talk about the Tony Grove Nature Trail. This is a developed trail with interpretive signs and boardwalks that runs around the north end of Tony Grove Lake for maybe half a mile.
So disabled access?
I have to tell you this, that the boardwalks that they put in are these composite ones, and they look like a roller coaster in some places.
Gotcha. So be ready.
Be ready for that. I'm sure they intended it for disabled access. The reason I want to talk about this now is because there are some flowers there that are some of my absolute favorites. And the one I'm going to start with is Pedicularis greenlandica, the elephant's head. Now, I first knew elephant's head from the Uinta Mountains. It grows all over the place in the high meadows. But here in northern Utah, we don't see it very often. And this is one of the fortunate places that we have there along the nature trail.
So where do they get elephant's head if that means Greenland or lousewort?
Well, the name lousewort comes from the olden days when the superstitious farmers thought that the presence of lousewort in the fields would cause their animals to become infested with the lice. That's, of course, a myth. But they had funny-looking flowers, so maybe they look like bugs to somebody. So that may have triggered that belief. And Greenlandica, just because it's named for Greenland, I'm sure it's found there. It's found around a lot of the areas of the northern hemisphere.
And I see from your notes that it's in the snapdragon family?
Yes, the Scrophulariaceae, the snapdragon family. A lot of more interesting shaped flowers we have are in that family.
And how tall are they? What kind of color will you see with those?
Well, they grow about a foot tall, and they're a purple colored. They only grow in wet, moist areas. And so this is one of the nice things about the Tony Grove Nature Trail. There's some water that comes in from the north edge, and you'll find it in the moist areas. There's a few other places around in the area, but that's a guaranteed spot to identify this plant.
And I'm guessing from the name elephant that it looks like it's an elephant?
It's absolutely fascinating. It looks like an elephant. It has ears and a long curly trunk that comes up around. And what's really interesting is that this is a result of coevolution between bumblebees and the flower. By mutual evolution, they've changed, adopted to each other, adapted to each other to where they aid pollination.
And so what is the bee doing to, what does it look like when a bee flies to this flower?
Well, there's no nectar, which is interesting. The bumblebee comes up and grabs a hold of the flower, and to hang on, it grabs it with its mouth parts and its feet, and it has to fly to keep on buzzing to stay attached. And as it buzzes, this elephant's trunk comes up behind and pokes the bee right in the middle of the back, and it picks up pollen that might be there from another. That's where the female part, the anther, is. And then it also releases a bunch of pollen, which dusts the bee as it buzzes. So the bee picks up a load of pollen, which it uses for food, and at the same time, it pollinates the flower.
So how cool is this? That, I mean, this bee must really want that particular pollen. I mean, it's learned that it's, I don't know, a little, has there's more to it? Or I mean, why go through all the trouble?
Well, you probably ought to ask an entomologist about some of these details. But I do know that the bees visit other flowers and other different bees visit these. But this is a specialized relationship between the genus of the multiple species of the bumblebee and this particular flower.
And what an adaptation, because how many flowers are going to have something that sticks out and touches the back of the bee? So maybe he's already been at the one and there's some specks of pollen on the back and picks it up and flies off to the next one.
Well, it's even more interesting than that, because where it pokes the bee is right in the middle of its back where it has a hard time cleaning the pollen, just like you have a hard time scratching yourself in the middle of the back. So the bees get pollen all over. When they visit the plant, their hairs are covered with the sticky pollen, and then they comb it into little sacks on their feet. Well, they can't get that part in the middle very good, and so when it goes to another flower, there's pollen ready for pollination.
Okay, that's pretty neat. And this flower is about itself, the flower is what?
It's only about a half an inch long. It's on a tall, well, about a foot tall spike with these whole stack of these little purple flowers up and down it.
Okay, sounds pretty neat. What's our next favorite flower in this area?
Well, while you're there, you'll see another one of my favorites. This is the white bog orchid. It's not really spectacular to look at. It's it grows in the same swampy areas.
And is it a true orchid?
It is a true orchid.
Okay.
It has a hollow green stem and these little white flowers that are kind of interesting. They have little long petals. The scientific name refers to the strap shape of the petals. Apparently, this is pollinated by moths, and it attracts them by scent. Now, I have to tell you that I should probably be more aware of this, but I did not kneel down in the bog and sniff these things. I wouldn't recommend it there because you'd leave the hiking the trail, you'd cause some damage. But it's supposed to be quite fragrant. And one of the names for this, besides white bog orchid, which doesn't sound real good, it's called the scent bottle. So probably because of the fragrance.
And you'll see this in the same place as you would see the elephant head?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And the third plant I'd like to talk about is a little bit more widespread, but it also grows there, not quite as moist of areas, but in the shady, cool areas of our mountains. And this is an interesting name because it's the blue columbine. The blue columbine is the Colorado state flower, and it is blue, at least the half of the, well, the sepals are blue, the petals are white. And in the columbines, the sepals look like petals. So if you look at the columbine, it has these flat petals with spurs with the nectaries in them, and then between the petals are the five sepals that are colored in Colorado, at least. Here in Utah, they're white. And there's a gradation of color between Colorado and Utah, and in the high Uintas, when I'm in the eastern high Uintas, I see these pale blue columbines. It's really interesting.
So any reason why the adaptation for white versus the blue?
Well, that goes back to pollination again. It's thought that that's an adaptation for moths. Moths go by smell and not so much by color, and so the spurs get longer to accommodate the mouth part of the moths, and the color disappears because it's not necessary, I guess.
So they're not pollinated as much by moths in Colorado as they are in Utah.
That's my understanding.
Wow. Okay. I really like that kind of information when I'm looking at my flowers. And this is another one that grows in shady, moist areas in the mountains.
It's not quite as moist as the other two. You'll see this in meadows, under trees, and shady, but it's always a cooler area and a little bit moister than the open slopes.
I know I've seen it on the hike to White Pine Lake.
It grows, there's a lot there. In fact, That's the day that I looked at this recently. Of course, I saw it on the nature trail, but I also went on the White Pine Lake Trail a little bit, and it's found it is inside a clump of trees, a really nice stand of it.
Let's talk about the trail itself. There's a large parking lot. Services as far as having toilets are readily available. There is a fee for parking. How much is that?
Well, it's $6 now, but first let's talk about how you get there.
Okay.
If you start at Logan, you drive up Highway 89 towards Yellowstone and Bear Lake. About 20 miles, you'll near, I think it's mile marker 481, excuse me. There's a road that goes to the left, heads up toward the west. That's the Tony Grove Road. About 7 miles, you follow that and come to a parking lot at the end, and that's where you'll pay your fee, and you can walk around the lake if you wish. You can use the restrooms and so on.
There's a large pullout off of US 89 for snowmobilers. That might be an indication. There is a sign, but if you get to the Red Bank Campground, then you've gone too far to turn around and go back.
And when you first take the road off from Highway 89, you'll immediately turn to the south. If you go straight west, you'll go to another campground. It'll be obvious, though.
Okay, so once you get to the parking lot, you parked, paid your fee, where do you go?
Okay, at the west end of the parking lot, this is the opposite end you entered, there are three trails that start. One is a real short one that goes to some picnic tables. Another one heads off towards White Pine Lake. This is the one on the right, heads off toward White Pine Lake and Naomi Peak. And the one in the middle is the nature trail. And you know right away that you're on the nature trail because within 100 yards you'll be arriving at one of these displays with the interpretive sign on it.
And are those all around the lake, these interpretive displays?
The nature trail only goes about a half a mile.
Okay.
It's just around the north end. There's multiple interpretive signs, and it circles through some dry meadow area and then sagebrush meadow and then into the wet areas, and it comes back into the dry again, and it comes back down towards the lake, and that's it. You can go back if you've seen all you care to, or you can hike around the lake for a 1 mile hike, and you have many other options as well in that area.
As far as being available for the disabled all the way around the lake, that might be, I don't think you can get in a wheelchair all the way around, but.
No, I haven't hiked it recently all the way around, but I don't think so. However, they did improve the trail a few years ago when they rebuilt the dam. Since they rebuilt the dam, I've not walked around it, but from what I see from the parking lot, it looks like it's in good shape. But I would be careful if I'm not completely confident of going out there with a wheelchair unless and be prepared to take some other options.
And how much time would you spend just to make sure you have enough to see everything?
Oh, this is entirely dependent on you, I'd say. If you have little kids that are interested, you might spend an hour on the first half mile, or you could walk around the whole thing within less than an hour if you weren't stopping too much. I guess it's pretty flexible.
And given the lack of snow cover this year and moisture, these flowers are out right now. Usually, some years it's been several weeks later.
I'd say that July, the first week in July, is when we used to go up to do some wildflower walks, and it's pretty good for the whole month. Some species will be coming and going. The ones I talked about, I think, will be there for most of July.
Okay.
I want to point out, if you're taking this other hike, the whole area, the herbarium here at Utah State University on their webpage has a checklist. So you can go there and download this list of all the plants that are available.
And we have that at our website at upr.org. So this sounds like a great hike, and this is at Tony Grove. We've got three species of flowers we've talked about, the elephant head flower, the white bog orchid, and the blue or Colorado columbine. David, thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.